From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Sunny and Cher will feature interviews in which they each talk about life before, during, and after the Sunny and Cher era. Sunny is now a freshman Republican congressman, just re-elected to another term. This year, Cher co-directed a film for HBO, which she also co-starred in, and released her first new record in 5 years. Sunny and Cher, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On today's archive edition, we reunite Sunny and Cher. Well, sort of. We'll feature interviews with each of them. In the mid-60s, Sunny and Cher were the hippie novelty act with hits like The Beat Goes On and I've Got You, Babe. In the 70s, they became the hippie showbiz couple, hosting their own variety show. The Sunny and Cher Comedy Hour is now rerun on Nick at Night's TV Land. When they split up, Cher became a superstar, Sonny appeared to be washed up. But then he started a new life, first by entering the restaurant business and then moving into politics. He was elected mayor of Palm Springs, then was elected to Congress in 1994. He was just reelected. What a lot of people don't know is there is a lot more to Sonny Bono's rock and roll resume than Sonny and Cher. For example, he worked with the great producer Phil Spector. When I spoke with Sonny 5 years ago, we started with a song he wrote that became Sonny and Cher's first big hit.
The beat goes on. The beat goes on. Drums keep pounding a rhythm to the brain. La-da-da-da-dee. La-da-da-da-da. Charleston was once the rage, uh-huh. History has turned up.
Sonny Bono, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let me ask you before we start talking about your career, if you think that there are certain stereotypes that people have of you.
Yes. I think that when a show's on the air and as popular as the Sonny and Cher show is, and you play a character, people, and the character's believable, then they believe that character. And so that kind of is who they think you are. And I'm sure that's happened to me.
So who is that? What is the idea people have of you?
Well, I think basically From that show, the character that I played was a straight man, kind of a doofus, the guy that took the brunt of the shots. So I think it was a lovable character and warm and likable, but that was the guy. I think it was a doofus kind of thing.
Well, let's talk about how you got your start. Your idol when you were growing up was Frankie Lane.
And yeah.
I'll confess to you, I was a big fan of his, too. But for me, it was because of, like, Rawhide.
Oh.
I thought he sang that so well, you know.
He got into that.
Yeah, really. So you wrote your first song with Frankie Lane in mind.
Yeah. Frankie Lane was the hot number when I was a kid in school, and he was the kind of real stylist then. So he had this sexy kind of drawl. I patterned everything after Frankie Lane. When I wanted to sing, I tried to imitate him. And then I wanted to, when I wanted to write, I wanted to write for Frankie Lane. And by the time I started writing songs, though, Frankie Lane got cold, as we say in show business. So even if he could get a song to him, it didn't mean too much in that day.
So you tried to get a song to him?
Yeah, I did. I in fact did get a song to him. I think what he did, and he liked it very much. I think what he didn't, the part I didn't know, by then I was, 19 or 20, what I didn't know was that he was cold and he couldn't get a recording contract himself, but he owned a record, little independent record company.
And you got a job at that company, and that led you to other record companies.
Well, I was just a writer there. And that was Crystal Records. I was just a songwriter, and they liked all the songs I wrote, so they would see me often and see what I had. And my two stops when I went to Hollywood would be, I used to deliver meat, and I'd stop at two record companies mainly because of my reception. I'd stop at Specialty Records and Crystal Records. In Specialty Records, they liked my material as well. But Specialty was a very successful label. They had Little Richard, Don and Dewey. They had Sam Cooke as a soul stirrer then. He wasn't Sam Cooke. He was one of the soul stirrers. But they were. They had Lloyd Price, Percy Mayfield, all these blues artists. So they were very successful as an independent label, incredibly successful.
Well, when you got a job at Specialty Records, one of your songs, one of your first songs, was recorded by the group Don and Dewey, the rhythm and blues duo.
Yeah.
And the song was Coco Joe, and this is a song about the coolest monkey in town.
Yeah, right.
What led you to write the song?
Well, when I was a box boy at a store, they came out with a Coco Joe, and I thought, oh, what a great name, Coco Joe. And so I write this real cute little Calypso song, you know, because Calypso was happening, Belafonte was happening. That was when I was about 17. And then I get to Specialty and I sing it for Don and Dewey, and they are two raving hardcore blues singers. And so this little, in the jungle there's a monkey, that's the way that I sang it. And they go, in the jungle there's a monkey, bam, you know. And I never heard a song change personality so much in my life. Then later on, the Righteous Brothers recorded it. So actually, that was... probably the first or second song that I wrote.
Well, let's give it a spin.
Okay.
In the jungle, there's a monkey named Coco Joe, the coolest little monkey that you ever know. He don't have a tail like the other monkeys do. He trimmed it, it suede, and it dyed it blue. Coco Joe, let me tell you about a Coco Joe. With a crazy drink, you should see his walk, it's the funniest thing. He changed the stroll to the monkey swing. Coco Joe, now let me tell you about a Coco Joe. Coco Joe, the coolest little monkey in town.
Was it hard as a 22-year-old producer to work with a kind of wild rhythm and blues group like you were?
No, it was fascinating and fun. I loved it. I loved black music because that was they were much more liberal about what you wanted to sing or who you were or what your intention was, you know. In that day, Decca and Capitol and Brunswick and RCA were the hot labels, and they just had an attitude about music, and it had to be the certain thing. So it was like the big companies now. You couldn't get in. So, but you went to these black artist labels, you know, they were very flexible, very liberal, and allowed you to be. And so they overcame the music industry because of their attitude, but the black labels were that way. And you know, I first started with Johnny Otis, who let me record on his label, which was Dig Records, you know, and that was the first song I wrote called Ecstasy. So being in that environment with Little Richard and Don and Dewey and Larry Williams, I was in heaven, just absolute heaven.
My guest is Sonny Bono. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sonny Bono. Now, I'll confess, I just found out this week that you wrote Needles and Pins, and I feel bad. I should have known that you wrote that and should have, like, given you credit for that, you know, in my mind.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of people, of all the songs I've written, that song, people go, I didn't know you wrote that.
Yeah.
I thought Jackie DeShannon wrote that.
I always just think of The Searchers, you know. I don't even think of Jackie DeShannon.
Yeah, nobody makes the association. So you're not alone.
So did you work on the lyrics?
I worked on it both.
You worked on both?
It was me and Jack Nitzsche, and I had hired Jack Nitzsche to write lead sheets for Specialty Records, and then we became very, very close, and we were like family to his family, and my family hung out together all the time. So we'd talk about music and for days and hours and hours and days and months. That's all we talked about. And Jack could play a piano pretty well, you know. And he had this riff, you know, do 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 do, and he just couldn't get it out of mind. He goes, "I love this riff. I love this riff. I love this riff." So one night we had nothing to do, so it wasn't planned or preconceived. So we started fooling around, and then Needles and Pins came out, and pretty soon we had a whole song. So we just kind of assembled it, whatever parts we could contribute. So nobody specifically went to lyrics or music.
Well, the question I always wanted answered about Needles and Pins was whether you wrote Needles and Pinza. You know, now it Beginza.
Yeah.
Where did that extra syllable come from?
The Pinza. I don't, you're always looking for little hooks, what we call hooks when you write, you know. And it also comes from, I kind of always tried to fancy myself as a blues singer, if I could sing. And so the blues always kind of, blues singers always kind of added these little extra syllables to words or phrase differently. So it was a phrasing that I had. And then Jackie DeShannon heard that phrasing, and she just jumped right on it.
Now, you worked with Phil Spector for a while,
yeah,
as a promo man, and then helping him with production. As a promo man, what was your style in getting airplay on stations? I imagine it wasn't hard to get those records airplay.
It was a piece of cake. I mean, all I had to do was take a record into the station. When I was a promotion man for Philip, he was as hot as he could be, and they couldn't wait to get the next Phil Spector record. So, fortunately, I didn't have to do anything except get the record to the radio station.
Everyone who's ever worked with Phil Spector has great Phil Spector stories. One that you tell that I especially like in your new book is about how Spector would always practice looking cool. Would you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Philip was the most unique creature I ever met in my life, especially at that time, because in the early 60s, all the things that were standardized were so embedded, nobody thought in different form other than what was standard, you know. So when you were a singer, you dressed standard. You had the little short suit with the string tie, and the whole world then was pretty conformed. So I get a job with Philip, and I meet this little guy who's just a total nonconformist. His hair was long. He dressed in the most bizarre fashion, and he produced in the most bizarre fashion. Before I wanted to work with Philip because I wanted to see how this guy produced. Up until then, when I produced, I'd have one piano, one guitar, two saxophones or whatever. And here you go in the studio and there's three pianos lined up, four guitars lined up, three drummers lined up, and I go, my God, what is going on here? You know, three percussionists, and then a whole sax section. So that was one session. I never saw anything like it in my life. So everything that Philip did was revolutionary. And when he recorded, he'd be wearing sunglasses, and he was just totally cool. And he was always aware that he was a performer. Philip really wanted to be the star. Anybody that sang really was an offshoot of Philip. So he was the star of his label, not the artist. You know, Darlene Love really didn't get that much recognition. Even Ronnie, it was Philip who was the real star. You know, so this guy lived that way. The funniest time I ever had with him trying to impress us was we shopped at the market on Vine Street, which was a big market, at 12 o'clock, and he was a weird looking guy and people looked at him, and pretty soon I was weird looking too because I wanted to be like Philip. And so he studied French lessons a little bit, so he said to me, he gave me French words to answer back to him, as he wanted us to pretend we were two French people in this market. And so he gave me French words to say back to him when he would say sentences. And so he'd say a sentence, and I'd absolutely screw up the response because I think the most difficult language in the world was French. But here we are in a supermarket, two idiots, dressed bizarre, speaking French, hoping people would notice us. And that was Phil's style.
Among the many things you did was backup vocals for some of Spector's records. And you write that he used to call you his funk. Why?
Well, I have kind of a froggy voice, or I have a real nasally voice, and it cuts through everything. And so it's not a very smooth sound, but he liked it because it wasn't a smooth sound, and he thought it was funky, and it did cut through on the background. So I sang with the Blossoms and all the girls, and then later Cher joined me, and he liked that background sound, and he liked my voice in there. So when I hear the records today, Mary, I can still hear me, and so can my wife, Mary.
After working on production and promotion in the record industry, what made you think about becoming a performer yourself?
I always wanted to perform. As long as I could remember, I wanted to be in some form of show business. It's the only thing that ever really interested me. So however I could figure out a way to perform, I would try singing, but I really didn't have the pipes to be a singer. Or then I tried writing. And I just stayed in it, and I was good enough to sustain in the industry because I loved it so much that I could pull it off. So I just, as long as I could ever remember, I wanted to perform.
When you met Cher, you became a couple, and you performed together. You started off performing as Caesar and Cleo. What was the angle behind the names?
The angle then, in the 60s, you know, they had Dick and Dee Dee, Chubby Checker. Part of being an artist then was to come up with a gimmicky name as well. So nobody really had their real names. They always had these hook name, what we call hook names. So that was right when Cleopatra came out with Liz Taylor, and my haircut was as close, the closest thing they could call a haircut like mine then was a Caesar cut. And so, and Cleopatra was out, and I went, all right, Caesar and Cleo, that's got to be a hitting formula. What a great name. So that bombed real fast.
So when you became Sonny and Cher instead of Caesar and Cleo, how was Sonny and Cher different?
We were just a little more honest, and by then I think I had a little more awareness after watching Phil of how to approach a commercial market and how to write for it and how to produce for it. So I was much more on as a producer and arranger and songwriter. So I wrote "Baby Don't Go" for Cher and with me doing the background, and it was a pretty commercial song, and I kind of felt it was right on. And when I wrote it, I left Phil, and I borrowed $135, and that's how much that record cost.
Wasn't the idea initially for you to produce Cher, but she was too nervous to sing by herself, so you ended up singing with her?
Yeah. Cher wanted to sing so badly, and I always wanted Phil to record her when he was singing background, but they got along like a dog and a cat. And so he would never record her except for Ringo, I Love You. I don't know if you remember that, but that was a quick brainstorm that Philip had when the Beatles emerged on the scene.
I don't remember it.
Yeah, and he called Cher Bonnie Joe Mason. So there is a record somewhere called Ringo, I Love You by Bonnie Joe Mason, and that's Cher singing of Phil's brainstorm, and that bombed. Then I left, and I wanted to, because Phil just wouldn't record Cher, so I left, and then I wrote "Baby Don't Go," and she didn't like singing alone. She was really petrified of singing in those days. She was petrified of performing, and believe it or not, she still is, and so she felt more comfortable if I was out there singing with her. So I just sang the choruses on "Baby Don't Go," and it became a what we called the soft hit. It hit in California in the West Coast, but it wasn't a national hit. But it was enough to get a career rolling for us.
Sonny Bono recorded in 1991. We'll hear more from him in the second half of the show after we hear from Cher. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, we hear from Cher about her early life, how she met Sonny Bono, and about her career as an actor since they split up. And Sonny talks about life after Sonny and Cher. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After Sonny and Cher split up, Sonny Bono left show business, but Cher stuck with it and became a superstar. Recent projects include the HBO movie If These Walls Could Talk, which she co-directed and co-starred in. Earlier this year, she had her first new recording in 5 years, and she had a reissue of some earlier solo recordings called The Casablanca Years. Ever since the Sonny and Cher era, Cher has alternately been the subject of critical praise and derision. She won an Oscar for her role in Moonstruck and received much critical praise for her roles in Mask, Silkwood, and Mermaids. Yet for the past few years, she's been the punchline of jokes about infomercials, younger men, and plastic surgery. Glamour has always been a part of Cher's image. I asked her what her self-image was like when she was in high school.
Well, it wasn't very good because I didn't really like high school. I was dyslexic, and so it was really difficult. School, the whole of school was really hard for me, and I also found that school is not there so much to teach people. It's kind of there to just ground down your edges so that you fit in the square hole, so you're a square peg or a round peg in a round hole. I was kind of a square peg in a round hole. I didn't take smoothing down very easily, and my mom always encouraged me to be myself, and so I was. So school for me was just, it wasn't a very interesting time.
Did you think of yourself as attractive or unattractive in high school?
Well, I thought of myself as pretty unattractive.
Did that matter a lot?
Yeah. I mean, in school, you know, I wasn't perky, and I wasn't blonde, and I wasn't, you know, I wasn't like the role model of the time was supposed to be. So it was, you know, it wasn't a nurturing kind of time experience for me, high school.
I wonder if your self-image changed or changed radically after you become famous, and also after you had plastic surgery and your some of your face literally changed. Does your inner image of yourself change with that?
Well, I think my image of myself changed when I started doing something that I got acclaim for, because I was the same person, but instead of having people kind of look down at you for being the person, the moment you're famous, they look up to you for the same things that they were looking down on you for about 15 minutes ago, you know? So, and I don't think my ideal of myself has changed so much since I had my nose done and since I had my teeth done, because the reason I changed them was more for film than for my own personal, you know, for my own personal feelings, because I was really content my whole life on television to have the same nose and the same teeth. I didn't like it very much when I was doing movies because it was hard to photograph, and unless I had a certain light, my teeth, you know, kind of disappeared. So no, I don't think my self-image changed at all.
What was the money situation in the house when you were growing up?
It was rough. I mean, you know, my mother had two children that she took care of by herself with no help from our fathers, and so it was tight sometimes. It was tight a lot of the times.
As you said, you said from our fathers, and your mother was married several times.
Yeah.
Did you know your father well?
I met my father when I was 11.
Hmm. Did you spend much time with him?
Not really. I mean, I didn't care for him that much.
Why not?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I guess he didn't have the, you know, there's some sort of a security in being someone's parent and growing up with them, because you forgive people things that, you know, qualities that they have that you are not especially fond of. But when you don't really know the person and they just come in as a person, you don't forgive them that much because, you know, they haven't done anything really to deserve it. So my father wasn't really the kind of person I would want to hang out with or that I would respect very much. So I just didn't.
Now, I know you quit school at the age of 16 and left home. What did you hope for when you made that decision?
Well, I mean, school was not something that I thought I was going to have a future in. And when I left home, I wasn't hoping for anything. I was kind of just tired of, I wanted to be out on my own and I wanted to, you know, do what I wanted to do.
And what was it that you wanted
to do? I don't
know.
I mean, I guess what I did.
You started your career with Sonny Bono, who you were married to for several years. Can I ask how you met and started working together?
Well, I met Sonny in, I actually met Sonny in a restaurant, and he liked my girlfriend, and we just kind of became friends. And one time he took me to the session, and I really enjoyed, you know, watching the music Phil Spector was recording, and it just kind of evolved. It was a strange evolution. I mean, we were just kind of friends in the beginning for a really long time, actually.
Now, tell me about how in the early days of Sonny and Cher, you got a sense of who you were together as an act.
I don't exactly understand the question.
What your image would be together, what kinds of songs you would do together.
Well, our image kind of came by accidentally, because we dressed the way that we dressed at home. And when we first started out, we tried, you know, Sonny wore a suit and I wore a dress. But we were very kind of bizarre dressers, you know, in our everyday lives. And then one time we were doing this gig in San Francisco and our suitcase didn't come. So we just went on in our regular clothes, and people seemed to, you know, kids seemed to really think it was cool. Adults didn't like it very much. So we knew we were onto something.
And then did you make that even more exaggerated once it started to catch on, to try to be more outlandish?
No, it was easy. Both Sonny and I, you know, Sonny was outlandish when I met him, and I was too, so we kind of fueled the fire. I mean, we really enjoyed what we were doing, and we thought we looked great. You know, we thought we were really cool.
My guest is Cher. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
And the beat goes on. The beat goes on. Drums keep pounding a rhythm to the brain. La-di-da-di-dee. La-di-da-di-da. And the beat goes on.
Yes.
Back with Cher. Your film career started with the 1982 movie Come Back to the Five and Dime, and that was directed by Robert Altman. How did he cast you in the movie?
Well, originally he wanted me to play the part of Karen's part, the part of Joe.
Karen Black.
Yeah, and I really didn't want to do that part, and so I told him I didn't really want to do that. And I think he was kind of shocked, and he said, well, then what part do you want to do? And I said, I want to be Sissy. And he said, well, what makes you think that I should let you? And I said, well, I don't know, you don't have to, but that's what I want to do. And so that's what I ended up doing.
So did you like acting?
Yeah. I thought it was really fun. It was easy.
Do you think of yourself as a natural as opposed to someone who's trained a lot?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, absolutely. I literally have no training. I mean, I don't know about, you know, I don't have technique, which I'm sure in some ways would be beneficial. I just never learned it.
In the movie Mask, you played the mother of a teenage boy whose face was very deformed as a result of a bone disease. What did you enjoy most about that part?
Well, I guess working with Eric and the
relationship.
Yeah, the relationship between the two characters. It was really a great relationship, and that's my favorite part that I've ever done. So it was just, I didn't enjoy the filming of it very much, and I hated working with the director, but the relationship between Eric and I was so good that even Peter couldn't screw it up.
The director was Peter Bogdanovich. I understand there were things that you didn't see eye to eye with him on. What was the difference between what he wanted you to do in the role and what you wanted to do?
I think that the first thing is that he didn't really like the character that much that I was playing. He likes his women a lot more subservient, and also he didn't like when we were with the bikers and the actors that were playing bikers, he kind of has a disdain for those people. He didn't find the poetry in them, and so he wasn't very honest. So he tried to gimmick them up sometimes, or he just didn't face them square on. And I have a real problem with dishonesty in people.
So did you win in the acting arguments?
Yeah.
Was it hard for you to keep standing up for yourself since you were still relatively new in movies?
I was completely new, and yeah, except finally Eric told me, he said, you know, Ma, you're doing it wrong. He said, don't argue with him, just say yes and then do what you want because he never pays any attention. And so finally I learned that from Eric, because the truth was when I didn't argue and I just said okay and I went in and did what I wanted, he never noticed.
That's interesting. So Eric called you Ma?
Yeah, he still does.
Oh, that's great. Now, what about Moonstruck, that you got an Academy Award for your role in Moonstruck? Tell me something about your experiences making that movie.
You know, that movie just made itself. It was so easy. I never actually felt like I was working for a day. You know, I loved the people that I was working with, and I loved the story, even though I didn't think anybody was going to go see it. None of us did. So the set was really fun. You know, making a comedy is kind of an easy deal, you know. I mean, making Mask was difficult because I was always in tears or angry or drunk. Making Moonstruck was pretty easy. It was kind of a cinch. Also, I was surrounded by people that were really good, so it really didn't, you know, it wasn't all my responsibility.
It's interesting. Your male co-stars in the movie were Danny Aiello and Nicolas Cage, who have since become very famous and acclaimed, and they weren't very known at all when you made the movie.
No. Actually, I had to quit the movie to get Nick.
What do you mean?
Because they didn't want him, and I wanted him, and finally I said, all right, I quit. If you're not going to use Nicky, then I'm not going to do the film. I quit for 2 days.
Did you think you had enough clout to make that work, or did you expect you'd actually finally lose the part?
I actually didn't care.
Well, you were certainly right about Nicolas Cage. What made you realize he was that good?
Because I had seen him in Peggy Sue, and I thought anybody that would make themselves so out on a limb and could act so crazy and could go as far as Nicky went. I mean, Nicky is brilliant because he will go as far as he has to go, and most actors will kind of guard themselves and they won't go all the way because, you know, you might find yourself in a weird territory. You might find yourself looking foolish, and Nicky hasn't got those kind of fears.
You started your career as a performer with Sonny Bono. I'm wondering what you think of his career now as a congressman.
I don't know. I it's a job.
His politics, do you agree with him?
I'm not a Republican.
I have a question about your daughter together, Chastity. She came out a few years ago. What was your first reaction when she told you that she was a lesbian?
Well, I didn't react really well to it, I must say. For all of my liberal views, I thought I would react better, but initially I was really upset. I mean, I was upset for about 3 days, I must say. And then I kind of analyzed the whole situation and got down to what was really bothering me, and it was fine. I mean, Chas and I have a great relationship, and I'm really happy that she did come out, because it makes her life so much better, and she's so much happier doing what she's doing, and so therefore I'm really happy for her. You know, I see her feeling really good about herself, and I see her really blossoming, and it makes me feel really good about her.
You've commented before that it's interesting to watch your children, because you grew up kind of poor and they grew up kind of rich, and they have different values than you do about certain things. Where are the differences most noticeable?
I think that, you know, money isn't such a huge thing to them because it was always available, you know? And so they, you know, ran around in ratty clothes. Rich kids don't have they don't have the need. If you are rich, you don't have the need to go around looking at or proving it or whatever. And they're a lot more laid back in their lifestyles. They're not so, you know, they're not so into lavishness and dressing lavish or whatever. They're kind of more toned down.
Cher, recorded earlier this year. Now back to our interview with Sonny Bono. Earlier in the show, we learned there was a lot more to his rock and roll resume than Sonny and Cher. In his early career, he co-wrote the great song Needles and Pins. He was a producer at the R&B label Specialty Records, and he worked with the most important producer in rock and roll history, Phil Spector. When I spoke with Sonny Bono 5 years ago, we talked about Sonny and Cher. He told me that one of their low points actually led to their revival.
The low point was kind of where you get ashamed, or I got ashamed of myself anyway, was, you know, achieving all this success as a musical act and then letting it slip away to almost oblivion, you know. And so it was a real low point for me, and I didn't know how to recover from it, and I didn't know what to do. Music had taken a left turn and gone in a totally different direction, and I couldn't philosophically hook up with it, and so I wasn't able to produce that kind of music. So I was kind of lost there, and that was absolutely the low point for us.
When was this?
That was about 1968, 1967. Actually, things went on the wane. After about 66, things started turning the other way, and I think I wanted us to get into movies and things, and I don't know if I concentrated enough in music. I probably lost the interest that I had prior to this success, and so I wasn't writing the songs the way I was writing when I was really hungry. And then music itself changed, so it was real hard to get back into the scene again. And eventually we just couldn't get into it. So our market was gone. It was absolutely gone, and we were very cold. And so the only choice open to us then was to work nightclubs in hotels. There was still a nightclub circuit. Didn't pay very well. It would just keep you afloat, but at least you stayed in the business. And we did that. And now here we were working to thousands of kids, working to a couple hundred people in a nightclub audience. And it was way more intimate, way more scary. And Cher didn't like it at all because of the intimacy. And so she would avoid working directly with the audience. And sometimes both of us would, and then so we started that repartee, just to kind of keep our spirits up on stage. It was sort of a screw 'em attitude, you know. Let's just be us. So we would tease each other, and it caught on, and so we continued with that. And as it caught on, it became more and more sophisticated and got incorporated into the act. And then a CBS executive, Fred Silverman, saw us at the Americana Hotel and gave us a summer show. And we were back on the scene again.
My guest is Sonny Bono. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1991 interview with Sonny Bono.
When you and Cher split up, I'll let the personal differences go, but what were some of the performing and musical differences between you?
I don't think we had musical differences. The only differences, the only thing that we had that was different was Cher never really wanted to do, Cher always wanted to be a rock singer. Hard rock and roll singer, and she still does, I think, today. And it just isn't her cup of tea. So I think in some sense, Sonny and Cher were corny for her after a while. They weren't at first, not right as we started, but later on she leaned more towards that rock and roll, and she had an incredible desire to go into that direction.
Why did you have a hard time keeping in the music business after you and Cher split up?
Why did I have a hard time staying? I had a hard time staying in anything after Cher and I split up. I think part of what the show did was, although I don't believe it, and I will always defend this, it was kind of like, well, Cher is the talented one and Sonny is like the doofus, but... that image, I think, went across to America. And so when Sonny and Cher split up, Cher had more attraction and attention in the industry, and they just dropped me, period. So nobody was in when the phone rang, and I just couldn't get into the industry at all. And to compound it, I really didn't want to let go of Sonny and Cher. Talk about confused. I guess that was the most confused time because I didn't know anything else other than the industry. So I didn't know what to do, and I kept pursuing it. And the more I pursued it, the less response I got. And finally, the only thing that that you can do in that business when you were once somebody and then not somebody is you can work a lot of love boats. So I think I held the record on Love Boat, and I'll never forget one day I was doing Fantasy Island, same producer, Aaron Spelling. So I do Love Boats and Fantasy Islands, and I'm sitting in a trailer, and I'm going, what am I doing? I said, you're either on your way up or your way down. So it was very, very depressive. You know, it wasn't as glamorous as I wanted it to be or as it's supposed to be, because you're really on your way down. And I think when I called Hervé Pontoon in my scene, I forget what his name was, but it wasn't Pontoon. God sent me a message. Get out of there.
It must have been especially aggravating to not be able to stay in the music business since you'd been the writer and the producer of all the records.
Yeah, I never didn't believe in my ability or my talent, so it was aggravating in that, well, wait a minute, you know, don't you know I'm talented too? And so that message just wouldn't come across, and the more you tried to pitch it, the less it came across. If I was in the same frame of mind that I am now, what I would have done and should have done is you just start right back at the bottom, and I probably could have worked my way up in a year or two and been fine. But having been on top, you want to kind of start where you're at, and you're not there anymore. So it's a Don Quixote kind of thing, you know. You're chasing windmills.
How did you end up getting into politics after music?
The first thing that I had to do was I had to let go of Sonny and Cher, let go of the career, let go of all of that, and just be okay with me again. And then eventually I did start at the bottom. I opened a restaurant, and I was a busboy, a cook, everything. And I was the happiest I had been again, because I was creating my own actions, so no matter what it was. And when I let go of Sonny and Cher, my wife came into the picture, and we were having a good time. We moved down to Palm Springs. I had a home there for 17 years, and I wanted to get into business there, and I dealt with the city, and they seemed incredibly illogical to me about a lot of things. I needed a sign, and I was remodeling a house, and they weren't nice about it. And we would have these silly arguments about nothing. And I said, don't you realize you're holding back the growth of this town? And so then they red-tagged me because I was being a smart mouth to them. So then I went and talked to the mayor. And I said, look, mayor, you need this kind of thing in your town. And he was very nice about it, but they still didn't respond. So I said, well, I'm going to run for mayor then. And so I ran, and I didn't really stay stuck on my own particular issues, but I did start to notice that the town was sliding backwards, and that I felt it was moving in the wrong direction, and that it needed to be brought up into a contemporary period. So I got dedicated to it, and I enjoyed it. And so I landed on my feet in Palm Springs as a mayor.
Sonny Bono, recorded in 1991. You can see Sonny and Cher's 1970s variety show on Nick at Night's TV Land. We'll feature more interviews from our archives next week at this time. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Today's archive edition was produced by Joan Tui Westman and Amy Sallet. I'm Terry Gross.
Money's all been spent. lot, but at least I'm sure of all the things we got, babe. I got you, babe. I got you, babe. I got flowers in the spring. Wear my ring, and when I'm sad, you're a clown, and if I get scared, you're always around. Don't let them say your hair's too long, 'cause I don't care, with you I can't be wrong. Then put your